The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where we try to answer your questions to the best of our ability. Those questions coming in mostly by email from our website, occasionally a phone call. Today we're going to deal with a bunch of questions that have come in by email. I know we have a couple of Social Security questions now. We've had kind of a dry spell in Social Security questions, and we've recently discovered that the Social Security blog site, the place where you submit a question, was broken, and so the people weren't able to send us those questions. So we've got a few now, and my understanding is things are all fixed up, and we should have a nice flow of Social Security questions.
Hopefully, that does explain the...
And that blog site, for those of you who don't know, it's a long name, but easy to remember. It's simply helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. That's helpwithmysocialsecurity, all run together like one giant word, .com. And there we've got posts about basic Social Security rules, and then we've in the past answered questions there. We answer most of our questions now on this podcast, but that's a great resource if you're going to try to clarify some Social Security claiming strategy or some Social Security a feature or calculation or those sorts of things. We've made that a repository of information on Social Security. So thanks for listening now, and like I said, I know we have a couple Social Security questions, probably a couple retirement questions. Are there any more trust questions? We've had a big pile of naming a trust as beneficiary of IRAs due to a few EDU shows that we've done recently. In addition to this Q&A podcast, we also do EDU podcasts, which aren't really a Q&A. Instead, we pick a topic and drill a little deeper down, actually a lot of times much deeper down, and on the whole trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs issue. We drilled so deep we had to go into four different shows to cover everything we wanted to talk about on that topic. So might check out our EDU show if you want to get really deep into some of this stuff. So, Jim, do you have our first question today? He's frantically digging through the pile.
I am. I saw something that caught my eye, so I'm jumping them to the top.
Oh.
This is new for me and you. I wasn't planning on doing this one. It just came in the 10th. What day was that? That's yesterday.
That's yesterday.
Holy moly. You know why it's getting to the top. Why? What do you think he wrote in this that brings it to the top?
He probably extolled your virtues in some way or described you as good looking.
No, but that's another way of doing it. He's from Kentucky.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
What do you mean, oh, my gosh?
Everybody from Kentucky just gets put to the front of the line?
Well, he said George from Kentucky. He could be screwing with me.
I think he might be.
Yeah, he might be on to that.
Those of you who are new listeners, Jim has this dream that Kentucky is his perfect retirement location. And we've gotten a mixed bag of reactions
yes, we
to
have.
That.
We've
got some people that assure him he's making the best decision of his life, and others are questioning the
sanity of
sanity
that.
Of the
you know,
decision.
Someone sent me an email I should have read. I did reply back to him and thanked him. Kentucky scored last in the places to retire in the United States.
Uh-oh.
Colorado was 3.
Oh. See? I don't know.
Yeah, Colorado's state number 3.
You need to get the ranking of places to retire and grow a garden. So that seems to be
that's
your number
Kentucky.
One.
That would be Kentucky.
Okay.
And that was from a company called NerdWallet anyways. You're going to believe what something called NerdWallet writes?
It's a pretty popular place.
Is it?
Yeah.
Kentucky?
NerdWallet.
Oh. Well, they ranked Kentucky last. So I wasn't too happy to hear that. Okay, well, this one comes allegedly from a Kentuckian who called himself George. We call everyone on this podcast George to protect their anonymity, and he could really be George or not George.
We don't know.
We don't know.
That's what anonymity means. We don't know.
We have no clue. And he may be lying about Kentucky just to get himself to the top of the line. Well, but here is his email. Hi, Jim and Chris. I appreciate the podcast. It's easily the most, and he put most in all capitals, meaning we're supposed to like go most, informative podcast on retirement planning that I have found. You guys go into great detail, which I appreciate. Excellent, because we've been accused recently of not going into detail. I have contributed about $100,000 to my Roth 403B over the years through my employer at a local hospital. I intend to roll this, along with the earnings, into a Roth IRA when I retire. I'm in my 40s right now. Since this is a Roth 403B, I assume the contributions I made will be accessible pre-59 and a half without taxes or penalties. Is this correct? But what about the earnings? And would there be a 5-year waiting period after I roll it to my Roth IRA, or would that not apply since I'm moving a Roth 403B to a Roth IRA? We just answered. This is exactly like the question we just answered last week.
Yeah, but he was a little confused on it. He was just making sure that it works the way we described.
Yeah, listener, George from Kentucky, we just answered a listener's question on this. Was it last
week?
That's
why he's writing us. He wasn't quite sure he heard what he heard.
You sure?
Pretty sure. Because he just wrote this question.
Yeah, but he would have referenced that he...
Well, either way, the answer is the principal or the amount that you've contributed to the 403B when you roll it over, that's readily available.
Well, yes, the money you put in.
Correct. So if that amount of money will get you through to 59 and a half, there's really no worries about the 5-year rule on the Roth age. But in order to get growth earnings out of a Roth, those earnings have to be considered qualified distributions. And to be a qualified distribution, a few things have to be the case. One, the Roth has to be at least 5 years old. So if he's creating the Roth for the first time, the Roth IRA, when he does the rollover from the 403B, that's when the clock's going to start. So if he's worried about this, he should go open a Roth IRA immediately, get the 5-year clock going.
Right. He's only in his 40s.
Right. So he's got plenty of time to get this, although he might be retiring next year for all we know. He doesn't tell us when. I would assume
somewhere in his 50s or 60s.
Yeah. But that's one way to avoid that. But if he's going to start the clock when he retires, he then might have the earnings subject to some friction, if you will, coming out of the Roth IRA. But he can start that clock now and then not have to worry about it. But those earnings have got to be in there at least 5 years. I'm sorry, not the earnings have to be in there 5 years, but the Roth has to be at least 5 years old. Then one of a few things has to be true. Either he has to be 59 and a half, dead, disabled,
or buying a first-time home.
Now, one of those is really the natural way these are supposed to be used, which is reaching that 59 and a half point. So if you are making contributions over time into Roths, you might have so much in contributions in there that you retire at, say, 55, and the first money that comes out are those contributions, and you don't really have to worry about the earnings meeting this qualified distribution test, because they're going to be well after the Roth is 5 years old and well after you're 59 and a half. But for those people who might conflict with those rules, now you've got to worry about those.
Yeah, my biggest recommendation for him is listen to the podcast. Yeah. I think it was from last week. It was a Q&A. It wasn't an EDU, right?
Maybe it hadn't posted yet.
I don't know.
It's so recent.
This is eerily close to it. Yeah, eerily close. We just literally, listener, answered another listener's question on this.
It's not the same question, is it, Jim?
No, no.
Okay.
In fact, that listener who we just answered emailed us today and thanked us. He heard it.
Oh.
So it must have just posted. Because he emailed me today.
I think it just posted and he wrote his letter immediately to clarify.
So, listener from Kentucky, we have a EDU. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't an EDU show. It was a Q&A show. Mm-hmm. Look at the last Q&A show that posted. And we answered this question involving a 401k, but the rules are going to be the same for you with your 403b. Very, very similar question. But in short, listener, I'm assuming because you're in your 40s now, you're not looking to retire now, I would just open up a Roth IRA now. You can open for as little as $500 at many mutual funds. Go to like Vanguard or T. Rowe Price, and we're not recommending them. We're just saying that these are low cost, no commissions to buy them, low-cost, ongoing fund families. Just put $500 in and open up a Roth and be done with it. Because when you transfer the 403B into a Roth IRA, if you do not have a Roth IRA, you have to start the five-year clock. But then you look at the age you are when you transfer the money. If you are over the age of 59 and a half, your entire 403B assuming the 403B has been open for 5 years, and I'm assuming it will be by then because you're only in your 40s, your entire 403B will be considered qualified.
Yep.
The distribution is qualified. It doesn't lose that treatment. So when you move it to a Roth IRA, even if the Roth IRA was a brand new one, you've never had a Roth IRA in your life, the entire Roth 403B balance, contributions and growth, can come out of that Roth IRA tax-free. Why? They could have came out of the 403B tax-free. You're not going to lose that all of a sudden you move it into the Roth IRA and all of a sudden it doesn't maintain that.
Right. But that's only if he does it after he's 59 and a half.
Not in the year you turn 59 and a half. You move it after age 59 and a half when it has become a qualified distribution, so to speak, or it qualifies as being a qualified distribution. Now, if you move it prior to 59 and a half, and you don't open up a Roth IRA like we're telling you to do now just to get the five-year clock started, then your contributions can come out at any time for any reason, even from the Roth IRA, even though the Roth IRA isn't 5 years old. But the earnings haven't been qualified yet. You moved them before you turned 59 and a half. And if you did that, then you have to wait 5 years before you can get that out.
Right.
So listen, we get into it a little bit more deeper on the other Q&A. I don't want to beat this horse again. So we're going to stop your answer. I mean, I literally just read Kentucky and thought,
got all excited.
Yeah. A Kentuckian, a fellow brethren when I relocate in 15 years. By then, it's going to rank up there on NerdWallet.
Maybe.
You watch and see.
We'll see.
They're going to improve themselves.
Well, they can only go one direction.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't get much lower the 50th
last,
worst state.
Right.
I can't even see how Alabama and Louisiana beat Kentucky. First of all, it's hot and humid down there. Who'd want to live in Alabama
and
Louisiana?
You don't think it's hot and humid in Kentucky?
It's not as hot and humid in Kentucky as it is in Alabama.
I think it is.
No. Alabama's further south.
Same thing with
Louisiana.
I spent a month in Kentucky 1 week, and it was...
You spent a month 1 week?
Yeah, that's what it felt like. It was the most oppressive,
are you serious?
Sweltering heat
I'm going to have to go there in the summer and experience this Kentucky humidity. Because even though I love to garden, and the 70, 80-year-old Jim wants to garden...
It was in northwest Kentucky.
I'm going to move to the northeast.
Maybe that's better. I don't know.
I'm going to move...
My experience was not positive.
No.
No.
Well, don't forget, though, you grew up in Wyoming.
I grew up
lived
in arid
Colorado,
dryness.
Right? Arid
correct.
Dryness. Yes. I grew up in Boston. We have moisture there. It'll come back to me. Okay, but anyways, George from Kentucky, thank you. Hopefully that answers your question, but listen to the last EDU show that came out. We get into that much deeper. All right, let's jump into a Social Security question because we haven't had one in a while. Yeah. Of course, we know why now. Our question submittal thing on our Help With My Social Security website has been down for over a month. And remember we were saying, gee, we haven't got Social Security questions in a while. Literally, as soon as I found out, I told Laura, who told Chris, not you, but the company, Chris, that does our website. And as soon as he got it fixed, this question literally came in within a half hour. Mm. I mean, it's just crazy how fast it came in. Okay, so he writes, and he is from, Fine State, Massachusetts.
Oh, very nice. I had a much more pleasant time in Massachusetts when I was there.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's where I'm from. I haven't noticed. Okay. Oh, and his last name is a famous singing group. Wow. Wonder if he's related.
I don't know. We'll never know.
I'll never know because I won't say it over the radio. We're going to call him George. Okay. He writes, I will be 63 in November and plan to retire at that time. Mm-hmm. I have a 9-year-old wife and... Oh, no, wait a minute. I have a 9-year-old and my wife. Now, that would be odd if he had a 9-year-old wife.
Not only odd, but illegal in most states.
Even Massachusetts.
Maybe even Kentucky.
Hey, now that's just being mean to Kentuckians. What do you mean, maybe even Kentucky?
I don't know what the law is there.
That wasn't a hillbilly joke?
No. Well, it could be, but it was just because we were talking about that state most
if
recently.
People could see the grin on his face right now. Let me apologize for all our Kentucky fans. Chris didn't mean that. I will be 60.
You're the one who said he had a 9-year-old wife.
I misread. The word 9-year-old was right next to the word wife. Okay. I missed the three words in between.
And a wife.
I missed those words.
Of unknown age. Of legal age, we'll assume.
42. Oh,
plenty legal.
So he's 63. Mm-hmm. Wife is 42.
Yep.
9-year-old child. We got that settled?
Got the story.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. I've been getting confusing answers from Social Security. Go figure.
What a shock.
From the Social Security Administration as to what kind of benefits would apply in my case. On the phone, they told me my child would get half of my benefit until he is 18. But my wife wouldn't get anything until she's at least 62.
Wrong.
But can I finish?
Go ahead.
But when I went in person to the Social Security office, they told me my wife would get a benefit as the spouse in care of the child, mm-hmm. but that would be taken out of the child's benefit. Can you explain these two benefits and how they interact? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
That second piece of information he got from going into the office was much closer to reality, and the person probably knew exactly what the rule was, but was trying to make it understandable for him. These rules are quite complicated, and while it doesn't really work the way they described in the office, taking it from the child's benefit, effectively it's close to that. So let me explain. So when you are receiving your own retirement benefit, others can receive what are called auxiliary benefits on your record. Those others are spouses, sometimes ex-spouses, dependents, so children of certain ages, and also other dependents, like your own parents, if they are legal dependents of yours. So the most common, of course, are spouses and children. Now, the children, spouses are most popular, obviously, because they usually similar age, etc. Normally, spousal benefits are only available when the spouse reaches age 62. So your spouse, much, much younger. So normally, let's say the child wasn't in the picture, your wife would in fact have to wait to 62 to file for a spousal benefit. And at that time, she would get a calculated benefit that was based upon your benefit. The child, though, does also qualify for their own benefit up until the age of 18, or what they didn't tell you in there, or maybe they did and you've left it out of your email, up until age 19 if they're still in high school. So a child who is that young when you are claiming, so that means you've got to be at least 62, in this case 63, but 62 is when you can first file for a retirement benefit. Not a whole lot of 62-year-olds have children under 19 years old, but more and more do these days due to medical advancements of various kinds. And it's always happened to a certain extent, just at a lot lower percentage than having older kids. So where does this whole thing about if my spouse claims she will get something but it'll take away from the child's benefit? Well, what's happening there is what's called the family maximum is impacting how much you can receive. The family maximum is a complicated calculation, but in effect it says that the total benefits for you and all of those claiming under you on your record, the total benefits can be no higher than 150 to 183, might be 182, but we're nitpicking here, 183% of your primary insurance amount, your full retirement age benefit. So if you have lots of kids that meet the requirement, or you can't really have lots of wives, but hypothetically if you could, there's a limit on the maximum that can go out under one wage earner's record. And that's what's going on here. The child qualifies for one half of your full retirement age benefit, your PIA. Between your benefit, which is 100% if you were to file at your full retirement age, and your child getting half, there's the 150% right there. If your wife were to claim, it's true, she does actually qualify because that age 62 limitation for spousal benefits is removed completely when your spouse is taking care of your child who's under the age of 16, not the 18 or 19. The child qualifies till 18 or 19 if they're in high school or longer if they're disabled. Your wife, the spouse, qualifies until that child reaches 16 years old. And the assumption there is once they reach 16, the spouse, your wife, doesn't really have to be taking care of them much. They're more self-sufficient, so she doesn't deserve to receive a benefit. She can be working, for instance. So, yes, she qualifies for her own benefit of 50% of your PIA. Well, you're not going to get all of yours, half for your wife and half for your child, because that's going to be 200%. So there's going to be a limitation there, and most people fall more towards that 150% limit for their family maximum. So that's why the person at the office that you went in said, well, your wife could file and could get child in care benefits. The spouse is taking care of your child, in other words. But because of the family maximum, that 50% bucket that's paid out in auxiliary benefits is going to be split between your spouse and the child. So your household won't receive really any more money. Now, sometimes it is a little bit more because you might get a little higher than that 150%. So it's worth filing to get everything you can. But the second answer you got was far closer to the truth. It just wasn't quite as detailed as reality. So,
excellent.
Did you follow all that?
I did.
So, yes, your wife qualifies. Once you file, she should file for a spousal and you should file for your child. And hers will stop when the child reaches 16, but then the child
kids
will get
up.
All of it.
Yeah.
Will get all of it. So the household really won't see a reduction. The child will get essentially all of it until they're 18 or 19 if they're still in high school. And at that point, that's 10 years from now. Your wife still won't be 62 at that point. So it'll be then shut off for a while. Then your wife could refile for spousal benefits at
62. Ten years later.
Yep.
Now, what was I going to ask? Oh, it was brilliant, and I forgot what it was. Oh, when a kid is receiving benefits, when a child is receiving benefits, you have to document what happens with that. Do you not? Don't they send you an audit sheet every year and you have to say what you're doing with it? I've heard they do.
They don't.
Oh, then I've heard wrong.
They do in some cases. That's usually when you are receiving benefits on behalf of someone else as a... And it's on the tip of my tongue, there's a word for it, but essentially you're a designated payee or something like that, where the person can't take their care of their own affairs, but it's paid to you instead.
But even the child's a minor?
If they're your parent, the assumption is you are spending money on your child.
Because the money technically goes to the parent, doesn't it? Because the kid's a minor.
The money is on behalf of the... It's for the child, but it gets sent to the parent.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but the... now they could ask you for that if somebody reports and says, hey, they're blowing all this money on gambling, they're not spending it on the kid, and the kid doesn't have any clothes or something like that, then they, my guess is they could come in and ask you.
But they don't send you an audit form every year?
I know a couple people that receive these benefits, and I'm not aware of them. They've never mentioned that they've gotten those audit forms. But I have heard of those forms, that reporting, when you are a designated recipient. And I apologize to everybody for not having the actual title on the tip of my tongue here. But you can, for people who aren't, say, financially able, mentally able to take care of their own finances.
Right, if you're acting as an agent.
Right, right. Social Security can send the, but then you have to document that you are, in fact, spending the money on the person who you're supposed to and not, it's not for
you. Well, they put a lot of faith then in parents because... As a former police officer, I can tell you, I've been to some homes with the parents,
and maybe they do, but I've actually asked, because I was wondering the same thing, because I'd heard about having to keep track of what you spend, and these people claim to have never seen such a form and still continue.
Well, that
to get
might
the benefits,
be more of a reflection of the ineptitude of a bureaucracy. Maybe the rule is there; they're just not receiving it. But I was always under the impression you did. Okay, that's neither here nor there, but just one of those things that made me go, hmm.
I'd be prepared to supply that information if you
absolutely,
asked.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But as a parent, it's easy, you know, if you're buying them clothes and food and stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Here's someone who's not from Kentucky, but we will call him George from Texas. He writes about trust. That trust show has those series of trust shows have received a lot of questions and comments and obscene remarks. Okay, it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. I've been listening to your podcast for 18 months and continue to be amazed at how wonderful Jim is.
Whatever.
Someday there's going to be really an email like that, and you're going to be paying attention instead of looking at your phone like you just
No,
were.
I just listened to every word that you said, and I can tell by the tone of your voice.
I know.
That they did
I got to pre-write that so my tone doesn't change.
No, you're going to have someone else write it, because if you wrote it, your voice still sounds different.
See, I can't lie. I'm a lousy liar. I've been listening to your podcast for about 18 months and continue to learn from them. Thank you for the great information. I just listened to the EDU podcast called Trusts as IRA Beneficiaries Part 2. We received this email a while ago and had a follow-up question. Do the same concerns you discussed with respect to a trust as beneficiary of an IRA also apply to a trust named as beneficiary of a 401k? It's hard to keep track of where IRAs and 401ks are the same and where they are different. Thanks for your help. And again, we'll call him George from Texas. George, I would actually be more concerned, not less concerned, or even equally concerned, but more concerned.
What? Which one is it?
More.
Okay, more.
More. Absolutely.
We're more concerned.
I am more. And I'll tell you why. The rules are going to be the same. So if you mean by concerned, am I concerned because the payouts from the 401k are going to be considered IRD, income with respect to decedent, and if they build up in a discretionary trust, they're going to be taxed as income and exposed to very high trust tax rates? Absolutely. Am I worried that the trust is going to be written by attorneys who understand how to create trusts but don't know diddly squat about the difference between a beneficiary and designated beneficiary and how their words in their trust, which are perfectly legal to have in there for trusts not beneficiary of retirement accounts, but putting those same words in and naming that trust as beneficiary of an IRA will no longer let that trust qualify as a designated beneficiary, and instead it's just a beneficiary, which means the five-year rule is going to apply in most cases? Absolutely, we're worried about that. But I'm worried about 401ks more for one other reason. Most 401ks will not allow a non-spouse beneficiary to keep them. A lot of 401ks don't even allow a spousal beneficiary to keep them open. And they force you to move them. I just had to assist late last year someone move $1.8 million out of a 401k, Chris. Because, and this is a major company, I'll tell you off camera, off mic rather, who what company it was. Major company. Didn't want it. Forced it out. And it was the surviving spouse.
That's
a wanted surprising. Nothing to do with it. Wanted nothing to do with it.
So by what Jim means is the person has passed away, their spouse inherited this 401k, and you could normally, well, most of the time, leave it open at that inside that company's 401k if you decided to. And sometimes there's a reason to do that. A lot of times there's reasons to do something else with it. But if you wanted to, you usually can do that. What Jim's saying is the company doesn't allow that at all. They say you cannot leave it here, even though your deceased spouse worked here for maybe 30 years. Sorry, you've got to go. So you've got to move that out. And it isn't, you can't just move it out to your standalone 401k, really. It's going to have to go out into some other account.
And you see it a lot with non-spouse beneficiaries. I was shocked, too, on the spousal beneficiary one. And this was the surviving spouse. But a lot of times, 401ks are not in business. They don't operate like IRA custodians who deal with individuals and multiple people. But a 401k doesn't want to get into the habit, Chris, of having to track down all these children. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're estranged. The address and phone number on the beneficiary form is wrong, but the kid's name and social security number is right. And now they're trying to track them down, let them know the money is here. They don't want to deal with all that. They don't want to deal with multiple required minimum distribution rules when the beneficiaries are all different ages. And a lot of 401ks don't allow trusts as beneficiary, period, spouse or non-spouse, because they don't want the headaches associated with it. Who knows why, but they just, really, it's a way to keep costs low. They don't want to deal with that. They don't want to deal with it. So what happens, it's not all lost. What happens is now the trustee is scrambling, the trustee of the trust is scrambling to go open an inherited IRA somewhere, make sure that's getting all done correctly, then trying to deal with the transfer of the 401k and getting it reestablished. And trustees can charge fees, so this is going to add to the cost, and the trustee is probably going to be charging a fee on top of all this. So you have to be real careful. Oftentimes, if trusts are involved, I tell my clients, talk to the 401k provider first, find out what their rules are. If they're going to force it to be moved to an IRA, an inherited IRA, you might want to just do that anyways. Just do it now. Just move, not to an inherited IRA, you're still alive, but just move the 401k to an IRA, because it's going to be a lot easier at the IRA custodian. And it's a lot easier to move an IRA to an IRA than a 401k to an IRA. It just gets confusing, and there's more room for mistakes to be made. Because don't forget, one of the only ways that your trust is going to be a designated beneficiary is it has to be a see-through trust. And one of the rules, rule number four, Chris, the trust documents must be delivered to the IRA custodian by October 31st, Halloween, of the year following the IRA owner's death. Now you got this artificial timeline being imposed that the trustee probably doesn't even know. And they're going to, you have to start taking the RMDs by December 31st. Maybe the trustee doesn't know any of this. And now it's November and they're being told, hey, you didn't get the trust document to the custodian last month. You blew it. This trust no longer qualifies as a designated beneficiary. And now all those problems are arising. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say I would even be more worried with a 401k. Unless that 401k has some incredibly amazing investments that are totally not available outside of the 401k platform. And although I have seen investments that are not available outside of the 401k platform, I have never seen any that were incredibly impressive enough to say, yeah, leave it there. That is just phenomenal. It's well worth all the headaches. You need that money there. So you might want to take that into consideration when you're opening a trust. You want to use a custodian that's very trust friendly.
Yep. That's why.
Yep.
Okay.
And also ask yourself, as part of this whole thing, why are you looking to put this into a trust in the first place? And make sure that the reasons you're looking for are actually going to be satisfied by the trust that you're looking at. And maybe there's other ways of accomplishing what you want. A lot of people, I think, start going down this trust path only to find out, or maybe not even realize until it's too late, that they could have accomplished what they were trying to do in other easier, less expensive ways. So just make sure that there's justification for going down that trust path before you deal with all this extra complexity.
Excellent. Okay, let's get a few more quick ones in before we... I'll
probably do one more.
One or two more. Okay.
Maybe two.
Another trust one. So I okay. wanted to get to it. Wow, from February.
It's not that long ago.
It's April.
I know.
These things, you know, the problem is people, Chris prints these and leaves them on his desk and they get all lost.
Whatever.
Okay, this is George in Texas. We're all over the United More States Texas. Today. Another Texan. Mm-hmm.
Texas, Kentucky, Massachusetts. It's a nice mix.
Yeah. Another Texan. Hello, Jim and Chris. I was recently... Let me begin again. Let me try this all over again. I recently was listening to your podcast on how a trust could be used to prevent creditors from taking assets from a beneficiary. Wow, we did that back in February, that first show. Seems so much more recent, doesn't it?
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. Taking assets from the beneficiary of the trust. The question that I have is what resources or methods do you go through to check out the beneficiary's financials to determine if they are in the category of needing the trust and the protection? I know one method would be to simply ask them personally if they currently have creditor problems. But in my case, I want to keep that confidential about them knowing they might be a beneficiary of my estate.
That's
so here's a gentleman.
Question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And here's a gentleman that doesn't know if he should have these protections built into the trust because he doesn't know if the beneficiary needs it. And he's thinking, I don't want to go ask him. You don't have to, listener. Nobody creates these only because the beneficiary is currently going through a creditor issue or a bankruptcy issue or a divorce issue or a health issue or a drug issue. Any of the reasons why you may want to turn on or turn off the income, those are all determined at the time. You will create a trust with these provisions, giving the trustee. Now you're already passed away. The person knows they're inheriting the money. It's going into a trust. They're the beneficiary of the trust. But there's the trustee standing there saying, whoa, wait a minute, Mr. Beneficiary. Chris over here, who died this horrendous death, before Jim gets all the money, I have to make sure, per Chris's instructions, that Jim's not going through a divorce or a bankruptcy or a drug case. So the trustee determines that at the time. That's what I'm getting at. You don't determine it at the time you create it. Now, if you're a parent and your daughter married the worst person in the world and you know, hey, I just don't want them to get my money, them being the husband, you might create the trust right away with that language in it. And it's still going to be the trustee, though, who decides. Maybe your daughter is long since divorced from that guy when you pass away, and it's not an issue anymore. The trustee determines it at that time and maybe passes that money right out to the daughter because the terrible husband is gone.
And you might... Isn't there a way... this would be a good Pete question. We could talk to him about techniques for naming either the trust or a person who could then assess the situation at that time and then decline the inheritance, essentially.
Disclaim
it, and then it goes to the secondary.
Absolutely.
Goes to the contingent. And maybe
and that
the,
would
maybe
be the trustee as well.
Right. Maybe the contingent is maybe the trust, and then the contingent is the child.
Directly.
But it only goes to the child directly if the trustee says, nope, trust is going to disclaim this. We don't want it. We're going to block
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say. Only the trustee can disclaim because the beneficiary is the trust. Right. So what Chris is talking about is a strategy. You do not have to accept an inheritance. You have 9 months from the date you inherited it to say no. So what you do is you name the trust as primary beneficiary of the IRA. And remember, don't worry about anything. Put all the language in for the protection and control you want. You don't even have to tell the beneficiary he or she is beneficiary. The trustee determines at the time of the distribution if the beneficiary can receive it or not. What Chris is saying, you can do another thing if you don't even want to deal with the trust and the trust tax return and the trust right. cost and the trustee cost. What the trustee can also do, if you name as contingent beneficiary your child outright, not child, but whoever the beneficiary is, you didn't say it was a child or not, but you name that person, let's say it's Joe Blow, you name Joe Blow as contingent beneficiary, and you give instructions in your trust or in your will or in that letter a lot of people attach to their will explaining what they want done, you say, hey, if everything is fine, I don't want or just disclaim, don't accept, don't even create the trust, just leave it out, disclaim. In other words, the trustee says, we don't want it, and then it'll go next in line to the child. But to disclaim an IRA, the person needs to be named on the beneficiary form as a contingent beneficiary already. So if you don't name that beneficiary on the form as a contingent, not a primary, the only primary beneficiary is the trust. Mm-hmm. The trustee might say, okay, no problem. Everything is fine. We disclaim and the IRA can pass directly to that person.
Right.
And you would do that if you're not looking for long-term protection and control. Right. You're worried about that bad husband. Mm-hmm. And you say, hey, if my daughter is still married to that idiot, put it in the trust because I want to protect it. This guy's no good. But if she finally got rid of him or he left or met an untimely death, then disclaim and let the IRA go to my daughter.
And avoid the IRA mixing in with the trust and all that complexity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's called disclaiming. But you only have 9 months to disclaim. But the inheritor, the first person to inherit it, I don't know if inheritor is the correct verbiage or not, has to be the one disclaiming their share. And they can't choose who it goes to. It has to go to the contingent beneficiary or beneficiaries if they disclaim.
Yep.
But that is a way of doing it, yes, disclaiming. Okay, one more Social Security question, we're good to go.
Okay.
My spouse and I don't know where this guy's from, he didn't say, my spouse and I can file Social Security per your recommendations on the September 29th, 2018 show. Wow. Okay, so do you remember that show? Because I don't.
No, but let's just assume that they can.
Okay. Okay. We can do this since she will be 62. I was born before 1954. Can she file for a spousal benefit when I file at age 69? What happens to her Social Security benefit at that time? Do we lose it? My birthday was in 1953. Hers is in 1957.
Got it. Well, the only thing that the fact that he was born before 1954, he's probably referring to filing a restricted application. So I'll touch on a couple of things here. So let's say she files soon at 62, files for her own benefit. She doesn't qualify for a spousal because he has not yet filed. So she'd collect just her own, and it would be reduced because she's filing at 62 instead of her full retirement age. He, on the other hand, when he gets to be his full retirement age, since he was born before January 2nd of 1954, he falls under the grandfathering clause that allows him to file a restricted application, and he could claim half of her PIA as a spousal benefit and restrict his claim only to that and let his own grow until 70 if he chose to. Now, he doesn't sound like he's choosing to do that, but he could choose to do that. Now, when he files, she then qualifies for a spousal benefit. If the spousal benefit is greater than her benefit would have been at her full retirement age, they will pay her that difference on top of what she's collecting. So when he asks, would hers go away? Depends on how you count.
Depends
things.
How you look
depends
at it.
Depends on how
yeah.
you look at it.
The correct answer is, though, no. If you look at
technically
it,
no,
she's still collecting
right,
hers.
She's getting hers, and then they will give her a bonus on top of that that will top her up to what the spousal benefit difference would have been.
But it won't go down.
But it won't go, right. It won't go down. Nothing can make it go down. It can only help her. Now, some people look at it as, no, I'm just going to get my spousal, and I give mine up. That's not technically what's going on. You're really still getting yours. They're paying yours first and then paying you what's called a spousal offset, the extra amount above that. Now, her spousal, which is half of your benefit, is going to have to be bigger than all of her benefit for her to get the spousal offset. You didn't tell me what the numbers were, but if she was a low-wage earner, you're a much higher-wage earner, this absolutely can happen where half of yours is bigger than all of hers, and they would just top her up with that extra difference once you file and she becomes eligible for the spousal benefit. So there's a couple things going on there. The whole story about him being born before 1954 is leading me towards them being interested in him filing a restricted application for spousal benefits only, leaving his own benefit unclaimed, earning delayed retirement credits to age 70. That's the typical technique. That restricted application is gone now for people who are born after January 1st, so January 2nd and after of 1954. You can no longer do that. If you were to go in and file and you have your own, they're going to pay you your own first. You can't restrict it just to a spousal benefit. That was the change of the rule here a while back. There's still people that are grandfathered into that, and it's specifically those born before January 2nd. So January 1st and before. If you happen to hit it January 1st of 1954, you just got in under the wire. That's the very last birth date you could have and still qualify to file a restricted application.
Excellent. Okay.
Is that it?
Well, that was it. We got through five questions in record time.
Yeah.
So thank you, folks. Thank you. We got to get running. Both Chris and I have calls that we're running late for, so we have to get back to work, so to speak. This is actually the middle of the day, and we were working. We took a break to record for you. We are living, breathing, practicing financial planners in the state of Colorado, but we work with people throughout the United States. We do have a unique business model. Go figure. You just pay us for our advice. So if there's anything that you got questions on, or you're interested in our retirement planning services, our bucketing plan, our secure retirement income process, our beliefs of a minimum dignity floor, and how we approach retirement. Retirement is all we do, retirement planning. It is not a bullet point on our website under dozens of other services. We understand distribution planning. We understand these rules. Chris understands Social Security, as you can tell, much more than I know. If we can be of any assistance, the first step is just schedule a phone call with us. Go to our website, Jim Helps. That's JimHelps.com. Go to JimHelps.com, schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion. It's easy to do right there on the homepage. And we will hold a phone call with you. Usually lasts about an hour. I do these calls, so be forewarned. They sometimes go longer than an hour. But for the most part, I try to keep them around an hour in length. And we can see if there's a way we might be able to assist you or not. Anyways, that's all I wanted to say. I know we're both running late.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else?
No, I think that's great.
Excellent.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit JimHelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.